So it is my great pleasure now to introduce our speaker and my dear friend, Amy. Dr. Amy Cribbs and her family moved from Gwinnett County to LJ 13 years ago. She's been a member of MLUUC since 2012. She was previously a member of the UU congregation in Gwinnett, where both of her girls were dedicated. Amy grew up Methodist and Lutheran in churches with her family and has mostly fond memories of those experiences. Her understanding of religion and spirituality expanded considerably when she went to Japan as an exchange student at age 17. This experience led her to get an undergraduate degree in anthropology with a focus on culture and symbolism. She is excited to circle back to this journey she began almost 30 years ago and will be entering an interfaith seminary in September.
Amen.
After 20 years as an elementary educator, Amy now serves as an adjunct professor at three colleges. She's also the Mountain Light Director of Religious Education. Her husband, Chris, is an early intervention and gifted teacher at Mountain View. Their youngest, Hope, is a senior at Gilmer High School. And their oldest, Maya, is a senior at UGA. Amy is an absolutely hopeless animal lover, prone to bringing home surprise pets. Some of you may remember her adopting that gigantic white Vincent's. A Great Pyrenees dog that wandered into our church one Sunday and went home with Amy. They currently have two dogs and one cat, including Jack, who is the cutest little dog on the planet. And I'm not a dog lover, but I will say I do think Jack is the cutest dog on the planet. He is. So without further ado, please welcome Dr. Amy Cribbs.
Hello. I actually have two former students. I recognize a new face, Katie. Is that right? Okay. So the joy of teaching art is that I get to see just about every, or I did, and I saw so many elementary students that I pretty much can't go anywhere without seeing a former student, which is kind of exciting. And just by the way, my mentor from the seminary called me yesterday, and I missed his call because I was painting, but I've got my assignments and I'm ready to go. This journey has begun. Being a human is a completely and totally exhausting experience. I have an extreme case of sleep apnea, which doesn't help, but I'm referring to the mental exhaustion of experiencing our current America. I cannot seem to separate myself from the pain of our present culture of discord. I know I'm not alone in these feelings, as well as the acknowledgement that something's got to give. The fact is, we really can't go on like this. I've spent a lot of time thinking about what it will take to create authentic change in our society. This morning, I'd like to explore my ideas about the loss of community that threatens the fabric of our society and our crucial role as rural UUs in restoring our society's sense of connection to one another. Throughout this talk, I will reference the work of John Pavlovitz. I chose his work because many of us are familiar with it. In his book, A Bigger Table, Pavlovitz suggests that we can build a more welcoming spiritual community through total authenticity, true diversity, agenda-free community, and radical hospitality. I believe that these principles apply not only within our own spiritual communities, but also in our relationships with the larger world. I also suggest that radical hospitality is not possible or authentic without radical empathy. I want to back up to how the seed for this sermon was planted. Scott Dillard spoke to us early this summer about what it means to be a truly welcoming congregation. He spoke with honesty and compassion about the UU tendency to be critical of traditional Christianity and conservative political beliefs. His sermon echoed thoughts I shared, especially after an experience that Kathy shared during the discussion following the sermon. I've chosen a bigger table as the centerpiece of this talk for multiple reasons. I agree with the message of the book 100%. And after hearing John speak at Cherry Log Christian Church this spring, I have no doubt that he is a loving man with pure intention. But I worry that, like so much of what I see on Facebook, his blog does not live up to the radical hospitality we so desperately need. This spring, a group of four of us were discussing John Pavlovitz's visit to MLUUC. The group included three MLUU members, who are here right now, and a member of Cherry Log, who had come to our church to hear John speak. We were discussing the concerns visitors expressed about the aggressive political nature of the MLUUC talk. Our friend from Cherry Log added that someone in our congregation came up to her at the event and said, "I'm glad to see you're one of us and not one of them." Around the same time, I was working on an order for our MLUUC t-shirts. We ended up with two unclaimed shirts because the person who ordered them decided not to return to our church. She found our congregation too political, and she felt uncomfortable and unwelcome. This was not the first person to leave our congregation because he or she felt chastised for conservative political leanings. This isn't easy to talk about, but I hope you agree that it is something we need to address within our own congregation at the very least, if not in the larger community. I'm not trying in any way, shape, or form to suggest that I am holier than thou. Heaven and Chris Cribbs know that I've said some pretty ridiculous things, and probably today. The intention of this sermon isn't judgment, but to find an honest, healthy response to the shared pain that has become a part of our daily lives. I also think you need a little more of my backstory to understand my perspective and why I cannot be silent on this matter. Although my parents each voted the same way in the last four presidential elections, they had not in the preceding years. When I tell folks that I grew up with one Republican voting parent and one Democrat voting parent, they are astounded. I usually hear something like, "Wow, that must have been tough." They're even more astounded to hear that it really was no big deal at all. I know that this characteristic of my upbringing contributes directly to the heartbreak I feel because of the current political divide. During my mother's country decorating phase of the 1980s, we had a wooden elephant and a wooden donkey on our mantle. My parents always voted, and they always went to the polls together. They joked about canceling out each other's vote, and that was that. That's not to say they never discussed issues. I grew up hearing both of my parents clearly articulate why they voted the way they did, and for this, I am eternally grateful. I understand that I am not defined by how I vote. My vote is simply a reflection of the candidate I feel most clearly aligns with my ideals, and it is never anywhere near 100%. While I acknowledge that the political landscape has evolved immensely since the 80s, and that our political leaders give us more than ample reason for concern, I would argue that the need for civil, issue-based discussion has not disappeared. In fact, I'd say it's greater than ever. A second important piece of my backstory is that I haven't had cable TV in my home for most of my adult life. In fact, our family room doesn't have a TV in it at all, and neither does Kathy's, which made her friendship an easy sell. Our TV is in a separate room from the main level of the house, upstairs, so we have to make the conscious decision to watch it. I don't watch the news. I read it. I have noticed that it physically bothers me to be in a home where the TV is on constantly. I am extreme in my beliefs about the media, and this lifestyle isn't for everyone. But again, this directly contributes to my concern about our faith community and a larger American society. As I said to a friend recently, I don't feel that I'm losing my country to a president or a party. I'm losing it to social media and 24-hour news. Fake news and the assault on free press is a real concern. But I'm talking about something different. We've let TV and Twitter, Facebook and its fantasy, replace real people and real conversations. Again, I'm not perfect or exempt. Several of my jobs require me to use Facebook, and I will admit that I find myself killing time there more often now that I work at home alone. So this talk is for me too. So what is radical empathy? Change starts with a focus on the future and the power of intention. We crave something different, but where do we want to go from here? I personally believe that the root of our discord comes from a lack of connectedness paired with extreme tribalism. We are suffering on a societal level. Though I believe that our leaders' words and actions can exasperate or dissipate this discord, it is ultimately we the people who are going to change the tone and direction of society. I personally hope for a day that our society is less entrenched in social media and extended screen time, when we can use critical and thinking and discussion skills to address politics issue by issue and person by person, instead of as the playoff of the red and blue teams. I look for a day where we can find compromise and stop allowing the extremes to inform our perceptions of others. I also hope a day will come soon when our leaders are held accountable for impartiality, honesty, and transparency across all political affiliations. Excuse me. The work that will bring about real change starts with us, the people. Yes, a lot of change needs to happen within our governments, but none of that matters if the real people down here on the playing field have lost their connection to one another. Extending the bigger table is the answer to restoring lost connections, not only in our faith communities, but also in our towns and schools, across states, ethnicities, religions, and political groups. Pavlovitz describes the diversity we must welcome at the bigger table. Every church on the planet claims to desire, seek, and welcome diversity, until real, messy, diverse diversity shows up at the door, looking for a home, and then there's suddenly no room at the inn. Most faith communities have a diversity threshold, a limited level of difference, that they will tolerate comfortably. In the church, we're trying to have the deepest community, but beginning on a superficial level, which means eventually it isn't about magic, but about real, costly, difficult work. Part of this difficult work will involve moving beyond immediately categorizing people by their religious or political convictions. Real diversity needs to be a non-negotiable of the bigger table, but it's never accomplished without intention, self-examination, and brutal honesty about ourselves at every moment. Authentic community is not easy to pull off, but don't lose hope. As Margaret Mead and Barry Whittemore remind us, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. What exactly should we remain committed to? As you use, social justice and activism comes to mind. I consider myself an activist. I have marched and I will continue to march for causes in which I believe. But nonviolent protest isn't the only form of activism we use practice. We must look at our interactions with the community in person and online as a form of activism. We must be fully aware of the weight of our words and the intentions they reveal. In the winter 2017 issue of UU World, the Reverend Wanwa Hamani explains UU activism. Hamani is an elder care chaplain as well as a community minister at Mount Diablo UU Church in Walnut Creek, California. Teach us, therefore, to love. This line from a prayer by the Jamaican Unitarian minister Egbert Ethelred Brown speaks to the despair that our troubled and puzzled world brings and to the duty that comes with bearing witness to that pain. That duty, I believe, is the commitment to action that comes with the decision to call oneself a Unitarian Universalist. Our faith tradition was born out of the efforts of activists, people who committed their lives to bringing about social, political, and spiritual transformation. We often see activism as protests in the streets, meetings with local legislators, phone banking with community organizers, legal challenges to discriminatory laws. It is also the creation of music and art that shares the truths that cannot be captured by words alone. Activism is the use of liberationist pedagogies that empower students to co-create an anti-oppressive curriculum. It is the vigil in the public square we are reminded to say her name each time another trans woman of color is killed. Activism is the preparation of a hot meal for the countless protesters who have been sitting outside in the cold Minnesota winter for days. So yes, I do believe that to be a Unitarian Universalist, you need to be an activist. You need to love actively in the face of a broken world. Wow. We need to love actively in the face of a broken world. I would add that, as you use, this act of love calls us not only to express love, but to teach it. In the words of Nelson Mandela, no one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. I have to stop a second and get water. Sorry. I always have such a big thing of water, so I didn't want it sitting up there. Today's responsive reading revisited the lyrics of the hymn, Though I May Speak with Bravest Fire. This hymn was the cornerstone of a wonderful sermon this summer by Casey Castleberry. In his sermon, he reminded us that if we are not guided by love, then every word that we utter and every deed that we deliver, no matter how glorious they appear, are nothing more than illusions of truth. It matters not if our intent is to mislead others or if we are simply deluding ourselves. Without love, we are broken. This is very true and easier said than done. To say that today's climate is tense would be an understatement. Within the alternate reality of social media and 24-hour news, we are constantly confronted with opposition, often aggressively. Human nature is to meet aggression with more aggression. Can we, like Mandela suggests, teach ourselves and others to meet aggression with love? Meeting aggression with love is no easy task, but I believe that is the only way to bring about authentic change. More importantly, I believe it is our duty as you use. If we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all, doesn't that also include those whose opinions make our skin crawl? In a TED Talk, the researcher Paul Parkin describes empathy in a way which has reshaped my interactions and relationships. We often think of empathy as the ability to understand someone else's position or point of view. Atticus Finch described it as walking around in someone else's skin for a while. Parkin explains that empathy is more than this. It's not the actual act of understanding. It is the righteous struggle to try. The truth is, I don't understand what it's like to be anyone but myself. And most of the time, I don't even understand that. I can't truly empathize with even those who are closest to me, my husband, my daughters, my friends, but I sure as heck can try to understand. I'm afraid that the clear majority of society isn't even trying. Casey described cognitive fluency. The reality is that it is extremely difficult to speak, to love or speak with love to someone who holds beliefs with which we are completely and totally disagree. But I'm not going to give up on the notion that it's possible. If we are asking those with whom we disagree to see our point of view, we must be willing to do the same. We must accept the glorious fact that society is never going to agree. We must move beyond identifying groups by their worst extremes. We need to refocus on individuals, people, and the vast differences in our beliefs and experiences within groups, even within this congregation. So, let me get back to the idea that we, right here in this room, are the locus of change. This is where radical empathy comes in. If you don't mind, how many of you were born and raised in LAJ? That's what I expected. How many of you, like myself, moved to LAJ to find a simpler, quieter lifestyle? Okay. We are here in LAJ because we understand the best of both worlds. We are the point where two worlds collide. I am sure that, like me, you hear things out and about in town that make your hair stand on end. But I'm also sure that you'd agree that we really do have a pleasant community that genuinely cares for each other. We might have different frameworks and terminology for our beliefs, but our shared values are significant. That's why we're here in this little mountain town. And that's why it is so very important for us to choose our words to match our intentions and continue to speak with love, even when that's not what is being offered to us. We get it. We acknowledge white privilege and the struggle our brothers and sisters of color face to this day. We know that there ain't no way our LGBTQ friends and family are going to hell. And we understand that God is too big for any one religion, and we all deserve to pray the way we choose. But we also understand the loving people of Appalachia who feel threatened and misunderstood. As a final illustration of our need to start a bigger conversation about what we share, I keep going back to John Pavlovitz's story of the sign guy. Pavlovitz writes, "While attending a conference for LGBTQ Christians, I was in the coffee shop of a hotel lobby talking with a young lesbian woman about equality, compassion, faith, and about the bigger table. Just outside the window where we were sitting stood a man carrying a large sign that assured this girl that she was going to hell. I'll call him Sign Guy. He was yelling and pacing and quite clearly there to preach and not to listen. The girl looked at me and asked, 'So how do I respond to that? How do I love Sign Guy?' I was sort of hoping I could phone a friend. I thought about it a second and suggested that for her and me, the key is to try and see one fundamental similarity between us and the man, that we are all trying to do the very same thing at this moment, to hear and respond to the voice of God that we hear in our heads. So while Sign Guy's methods and manner are outwardly quite horrible, and while they are coming across as violent, hateful, and intolerant, in his mind, at this moment, he is doing exactly what we're doing right now. He is trying to be faithful to whatever image of God he's inherited. No one ever thinks, 'I'm doing this wrong.' Everyone believes that they are living and responding out of genuine faith. Radical empathy takes fortitude and control. It's hard work. Let me be clear. Speaking with love is not the same as being complacent. I'm not suggesting we remain silent about concerns, but remain focused on intention and outcome when we express those concerns. Self-reflection will ensure that our words move us one step closer to the ends we hope to achieve. It's also relevant to recognize that the most important conversations don't happen on social media, but around office lunch tables, at extended family meals, and neighborhood gatherings. As Pavlovitz writes, the kind of intimacy that was and is transformational only comes with close proximity. It is not possible to scream from across the road, or shouted from a pulpit, or laid out in a carefully researched dissertation. It cannot be gleaned from a clever meme or spirited Twitter exchange or debate. It only comes through the redemptive relationship forged when we are willing to sit across from people who believe differently than we believe, willing to get close and stay long enough to see both their unique humanity and inherent divinity. This is how we love people well. We aren't perfect, and we need to make room for our humanness. We're going to get mad at the world and probably our neighbors.
will feel rage and sadness, and there will be moments that will want to scream and yell, pick it, and maybe punch somebody in the face. These are the moments that it is most important to find love, which may be nothing other than saying nothing at all. In closing, I'd like to share a reading from my wedding. I imagine it's familiar to most of you. While I've always hoped for this to describe my relationship with my husband, I also believe it captures the UU love for humanity I've described today. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered, and it keeps no records of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Amen. Do we want to open it up? Do we have time? I feel like I maybe went over. Yes.
You have such a wonderful intellect. I just want to.
Oh, thank you. I want you to know I've never been as scared as I have been this morning when I woke up. This was really hard. I'm extremely introverted and shy and hidden behind my words, and my daughter convinced me to go to seminary and stop hiding. Yeah.
It is my obligation to speak truth. I'll confess I probably don't do that very well. I mean, I speak to it, but... Well, you know what word I use.
And, I mean, I'm not saying I don't feel that. It's just, it stays in here.
And I'm the first to say I need a better way to speak to it. But how does one speak to it? How does one... Whoops. Someone, what you are saying is abjectly racist. I see this hole behind you. Making it, it's not a political problem, it is a societal problem. And the politics have exposed just how bad people
do. I mean, my personal belief, and I'm still trying to work it out, I think part of the problem is pointing it out. Like, the way we do, not saying you are racist, but describing it in a different way. I don't know, because my point is obviously what we're doing isn't working.
But, you know, if you have a complex situation and you look at the physical world and say, what is it about the physical world that resembles what we're doing? And one thing I just thought of was lightning. When you have two highly polarized issues, positive and negative electrical energy, the only thing that can pass between them is potentially hurtful, dangerous, da-da-da. And so how do you address this issue of draining off some of that animosity, some of that duplicity, and having it not eventuate in something very... Because if I say, you know, you're a freaking racist, you know, this is not going to work, right?
Right.
You know, you're an enemy, you're whatever. And so where do you go in the middle, so to speak? Because we're so polarized, we're so tribal, as you said.
And I'll just share, and I know you're familiar with this, there was, interestingly, an incident on my Facebook page last weekend where I tried really hard to do that. And I want you to know that what I was saying on Facebook to this person and what I was thinking inside wasn't necessarily the same thing. But we actually maybe reached a point of agreement. And I'm not saying there's not a whole lot of the conversation still left, but we have to reach that point to move forward. Yeah.
I think in answer to that question, as you were talking, I was thinking about this. I think the way to drain some of that polarity off, and let me explain this, is to try to elect more moderate leaders. Because what's happening is, right now, the people in my life who are supporting the current administration are hard for me to accept because I feel like they are embracing the worst of him, when really they may not be. But it's hard for me to separate their support of from their alignment with. Mm-hmm. And so for the last 15 years of our friendships, when there was more moderate people leading the discussions, we were able to have camaraderie and love one another easily because we weren't assuming the worst of one another. And when you have someone so polarized leading a conversation, it's easy to assume the worst of everyone. So as gratifying as it would feel to support someone who represents the most radical of my ideals, I wonder if moving forward as a group, we should focus on finding people that are more moderate, that could bring people back together again. Just, that mm-hmm. might suck some of the electricity out of that. I don't know.
And I think a lot of it is, a lot of the hatred actually comes from a place of ignorance and fear, and mm-hmm. like you were saying, we assume the worst of others. I think a lot, instead of saying you're effing racist, maybe ask, why would you say that? Find out why they feel this way, why they're thinking it, and go from there.
Find the common ground.
Couple of things. I think the racist part is a regional thing. I've been in the Southwest for 35 years. I lived in Seattle. I never saw racism up in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. In the Southwest, maybe against Hispanics, but not against the blacks. And then I come here to the South again after 52 years. And I thought the black and white issue was in pretty good shape because I wasn't living in the South. It isn't. And I come here and I hear the TV on Atlanta and the news every day and the governors that are running and everything. I'm not a Democrat, okay? But I do like the black female governor who is running. Oh, I'm assuming going to be governor.
Stacey Abrams.
Because I know as a woman, she's worked really hard. As a black woman, she's worked even harder. She's not exactly slender. She's worked even harder. And so, and she's not exactly pretty. So she's really had to work hard to where she's, I mean, that's
it. But no, I know, that's it, yeah.
She's had to work really hard. And David and I have had many discussions. He's definitely not a conservative. I definitely am. I met him. You didn't vote for Obama. Well, yeah. So not twice. Well, yeah. And we have overcome. We have some heated discussions, but when it gets to the point that we're not listening to each other, we stop. Mm-hmm. And you made one comment in the early on about you don't have to accept everything in the political party that you're voting for. And I think that is so true. You can't, there's no one party that, I check all the way down. I mean, there's some of each of them that are good and bad.
Yes.
I have three observations. One is that I've always felt various degrees of discomfort in groups and in points of view because they weren't necessarily mine or something that I aspired to. I always found it easier to be the diversity because I could enthuse myself, I could educate myself, I could be the diversity. It's much more difficult to accept the majority as having rights, privileges, opinions. You notice a lot in social discourse that everyone claims a victimhood. That's saying, that's claiming a diversity to claim a victimhood. I was raised Catholic in a Catholic community. I am a hugely Catholic community. When I was in middle school, I walked past 16 houses up to the Catholic school at the end of the street, and I knew the two houses that had non-Catholics in. I wasn't allowed to play with those children. I couldn't go to their vacation Bible school, even though it was a fun thing. And yet, despite 98% of the people around me being Catholic, I was still taught that Catholics were, you know, persecuted, and we had to be strong and band together because the world was against us. And I looked around and said, but we are the world. I was 11 or 12. So I never particularly fit in to a group. And as I traveled through life, because of my work and accomplishments and what I was doing, the pond that I was in became small. I mean, I started out in this big pond and I was one of the smart kids. So then I was in a smaller pond, and then I went to a good college, and so then I was in a smaller pond. And I studied something, and women don't usually study, and I was in a smaller pond. So each time, the pond got smaller and I became more representative. But still, connecting with the people that were in that first big pond, which is where we live, in this first big pond. And I, in my old age and lack of energy, I've decided that my role is to witness. And so I witness who I am. I don't proselytize. I try not to judge other people. But I witness who I am, and I have a certain amount of peace and acceptance in my own heart. So the fact that I'm happy might make someone else curious about how I got to be that happy. And part of it is just a one-on-one thing. One of my two favorite images, one is, because I was a child of the 60s and a protester, is the image of, you know, the girl with flowers in her hair putting a flower in the gun of the, in Ohio, in the National Guardsman that was a threat to her, just putting a flower in the gun. Like, it was a simple thing to do that came from her authenticity. And the other is the little kid on the seaside, and I took little kids to this seaside where the phosphorescent jellyfish would wash up on the shore, and then the wave would go out and they'd be left behind, and some would never make it back to the sea. And the little girl would pick one off and throw it, and pick one off and throw it. And an older, wiser person said to her, you're not making a difference. You'll never save them all. And she said, save this one.
We have like one time for one more comment.
I just wanted to mention, it seems that the solution may be our children, but look at the burden on our teachers, and our teachers are overburdened, underpaid, and not capable. My daughter is in administration. She's leaving. The good teachers leave because they can get better pay. The ones that do stay are not teaching with the love that we would have. Of. How do we get with these teachers? Because that's where the burden is on the teachers of our children.
I disagree. I disagree.
The day of the teachers have everything in love in their hearts. I think that's really good.
Well, I think that the message we heard today
Amy is going to be huge in pushing our church forward if we continue to learn from it. Because we have, within our own congregation, anytime you have a place, oh, a church, everybody wants to come together in some way, like we all have to like the same things or think the same things, or, and I certainly felt out of place here because I live in a neighborhood full of Trump supporters, and they're great people, but it's just different, you know what I mean? So if we can take this and push forward, we obviously have issues in our own ward when we have people who are leaving because they don't feel like they have a place. So we have a lot of work to do here ourselves. And I think you're very brave, and I want to thank you for sharing, because part of being authentic is being vulnerable, which is terrifying. And that's what we have to do, is push past our fear to embrace each other. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.